you know, we all have a to-do list. There's lots of stuff on it. You got to get your dry cleaning. You got to get your milk. Here's an idea. Put save hundreds of dollars on car insurance on your to-do list. And the good thing is you don't have to drop off or pick up anything. All you have to do is go to geico.com. In 15 minutes, you could be saving 15% or more on car insurance. Extra money in your pocket. It may be the most rewarding thing you do today.
Now, Podcast One brings you Spike's Car Radio, a downloadable cars and coffee hosted by writer, comedian, and automotive enthusiast Spike Ferriston. Now, here's Spike.
Hi, everybody. Guess who I have here today? Mr. Kevin Pollak.
Could they guess? Is that a thing? Did you?
I think they probably would have seen maybe your picture on Instagram or my story.
You were promoting, were you?
I will be.
Oh, yeah. When will this drop? Like 6 months from now?
No, tomorrow.
Really?
Yeah. It's that fast.
Well, either that or you're just not ahead.
I'm behind. I have like 30 shows coming up that we're recording. You're the first of like 30, and I need a show for next week.
You're about to slam into 30?
Probably, yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it's going
to
be good.
So you like to take time off.
I do, yeah. I'm a writer. Well, I'm a comedy writer.
I understand.
Yeah.
And I'm a fan. And yeah. I realized on the drive over listening to you and Adam Carolla about the Ford Ferrari that – and I hadn't thought this before because I've been listening for a while to this particular podcast. Not all of them, but a lot of them.
This? Mine?
Yours.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're kidding.
Be a cruel thing to kid about.
I'm always surprised that anybody's
Me too.
Even
I always was too. I mean, I get that. I get
That's very nice of you to say.
Sorry for finishing up a note.
No, go ahead.
But, you know, Adam was, he was fun when I had him on my chat show. But I made the mistake of mine. I was sort of so early in the podcast world that you would have to explain to people what a podcast was. And that's still somewhat true, but not in 2009. In 2009, I had a machete in each hand. I mean,
Now the chat show is your podcast.
Sorry, yeah. So there's
and how long have you been doing it?
I quit last March. There's 400
wow
episodes. About 350 to 360 of them are video. Because for almost 10 years, I finished 10 years, 400 episodes. I said, that's good. If you haven't turned it into an institution, if your podcast is not a conglomerate that owns a building,
right,
you should stop doing it, is what I learned.
Well, you do so much.
I diversify.
But don't you find, you know, having done 400 shows, I always find that I feel better being interviewed or interviewing someone after that hour. For some reason, I feel better.
Yeah.
Emotionally.
Yeah.
I don't know what that is.
There are very few where I didn't feel better. Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, after Adam Carolla, I felt drained.
Well,
I felt drained of my life force.
Yes. Yes.
No, I love him, and I just did his show recently, and he's just one of the great ball busters of all time, so I always – I'm a California Jew, which means I'm basically Catholic, but he's very caustic for a California person.
Yes. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Especially
Southern California, because I'm from Northern California.
Right. You're from San Francisco.
You're going to get your caustic.
Yes. Well, he's the king of Podcast One. We love Adam.
Yeah.
You know what I like about Adam? He, you know, you can just ask him one question and then that's the 45 minutes.
This was what the great hosts of talk shows. I mean, Carson was the greatest audience ever.
Yes.
And Letterman was a great – and Conan would just love you to just wind it up for 6 minutes.
Right.
He could just sit back and not worry about a thing.
Did you do Carson? You did Carson, right?
I did a couple dozen Carsons, yeah. It was – there will never be a thrill like
that. I want to hear –
it was Christmas morning every time.
You know, I've never met you before. But I've been watching you forever.
Yeah.
From Usual Suspects, I think, is where you first were on my radar. Right up until
– You passed on A Few Good Men?
What's that? No, I said where I first started.
Oh.
Where I first started. Then I've been watching you since then, right up until Maisel, which I'm watching you constantly now in my house.
Why did
my
I
wife.
Think you were Jewish?
I am a little Jewish. Oh. My grandfather's name is Morris Fernstein.
Gotcha.
But he married Eileen Donovan.
And that's what why it became Fierstein?
And then he said, I can't be a Jewish doctor on the Upper East Side of New York.
Sure.
Married it, back in the day. You
sure.
can't do that because
right.
she's Catholic. So I'm going to change my name.
Fooled everyone.
Inexplicably.
Yeah.
Yes,
fooled everyone.
To Ferriston.
Right. I only asked because of the way you pronounced Basil.
Yeah. Did I pronounce it wrong?
It doesn't matter. So what I was going to say, clearly it does. What I was going to say on the drive over, and I was listening to you and Adam Carolla, I never thought of it before because, you know, I do impressions of my stand-up act all these years, so I have I have a trick ear, I would call it. And you could, if John Benjamin gets into trouble on Bob's Burgers.
Yes.
You could fill it.
Really?
It's weird. Wow. I never thought of it before. As I said, I've been listening to your voice for a while.
I would love to do that.
But on the drive here, there was a couple of... You just need to slow it down and be exceptionally droll.
Right.
And then you could slip right in.
I can't. I'm not like you. And this is what fascinates me about you, is your...
This is it?
This is where I'm going with it, because you're talking about me as an actor, and I know that's my limitation. I did it a lot in high school. I've tried it professionally here. It never works. I can't do the audition. I can play myself. I've been in things.
Please, you have no idea.
But I can't do anything else, and when it comes to somebody else's words, I have a lot of trouble.
Sure.
You,
on the other hand,
start as a stand-up comedian, right?
Yes.
At a very young age in San Francisco. Yeah. How old were you?
20 when I sort of took it seriously, but I started performing in clubs when I was 18, 17.
It says here you started at age 10.
Well, I performed for the first time. So my mother caught me, literally, home alone with a comedy album, lip-syncing it, standing in front of the 7-foot stereo.
Wow.
Remember the 7-foot wide stereo, hi-fi, where the stereo was a piece of furniture?
Mm-hmm.
Because my mom had brought home a comedy album. I keep saying comedy album because I it's difficult. I'm trying to make the jump on just how to say his name without any asterisk. But there's always going to be an asterisk there.
I think I know whose album you're talking
about. Well, because in the liner notes, it didn't say, "will be the most prolific serial rapist in history of show business."
Yes. It was a more innocent time back then.
It was. So right. I was standing in front of the furniture. Because I'd seen my parents laughing uncontrollably at this voice coming from the furniture as the album played. And I just thought, I'd never seen them laugh like that, ever. I didn't even understand what the guy in the stereo was talking about, but I saw my parents losing their mind. Almost as if they were openly sobbing. You know, it was that sort of raw emotion that was, what? Yeah, because I'm 10 years old. And so when no one was around, I put the comedy album back on. I was trying to understand... And also, I found it funny instantly.
Yeah.
And then, not knowing that lip syncing was a thing, not thinking that I had created lip syncing, I was just playing. I was just interacting. There were no interactive games in 67. So I just stood in front of this furniture, and I lip synced the comedy album as if I were the one telling the story. So that's sort of how I got the feeling of being the performer.
And your mom caught you.
And my material was Bill Cosby's first album. I mean, I was great. I was, talk about a writer.
Yes.
I was spectacular.
Mm-hmm. By the way, I pitched this show. I wanted to do like lip sync battle. I wanted to do a comedy lip sync battle. It didn't work. You can't replicate it even with the material unless you can do the performance.
Well, I would tell you this though.
Did your mom and dad laugh at you?
My mom saw me doing it and snapped her fingers at me and said, "You're doing that for the Zookers at Passover."
Oh, there you go.
And my first stage was a white painted fireplace with a little lip that I could stand on. And I performed for 20 to 30 people at the Passover gathering.
And Bill Cosby's material.
The Noah and the Ark routine in specific.
Wow. And how did it go over?
Killed, slayed. Because, again, it's his... material and his timing. And my timing was to clear my throat when he did by raising my hand up to my mouth. I mean, I had it down. So the sight of this precocious 10-year-old Jewish kid lip-syncing Bill Cosby, I believe before the serial raping began, 67? Are we clear in 67? I think we're in the clear.
I'm not sure.
I don't know that that story's been told yet.
No.
But again, not in the liner notes, so there's no way to know.
Mm-hmm.
So that was – and then I started performing that act in school.
Mm-hmm.
I did it for every gathering all through junior high and high school, whether it was the assembly, the father-daughter dinner dance, the folk festival, whatever the events were, get Pollock to do that bit. And then I started developing voices and impersonations and stuff on my own. And I eventually started speaking in my act. But, you know, I later found out that, you know, Jerry Lewis started by lip-syncing Danny Kaye albums. And this had been a thing. This had been kind of a weird tradition.
And it's even represented in the Amazon show. Maisel? How do you pronounce
Maisel?
It? Maisel.
Sure.
Right? Your son, the character who plays your son, that's how he does stand-up.
Well, he just straight up ripped off the album, which you know, it's another weird thing coming up super young in San Francisco, 20, stand-up. You did take from other people's act, material-wise, on occasion. If you were playing a satellite room outside of the city, you know, you would take a few bits from somebody else
really?
That no one had seen because you don't have enough material yet. And your job is to kill for 20 minutes, whatever it was. And I remember I was called out by one of the San Francisco comics. And he said, I heard you did my bit about this. And I said, yeah, like a true innocent. Well, yeah. And he said, yeah, you don't do that. You can't do that. So, you know, it seems painfully obvious.
Yeah.
But if
yeah.
no one gives you the rules, you don't know what they are.
You don't know.
Right? Now it makes me crazy when someone else's bit comes through my brain and I give reference to them immediately if something does come out of my mouth.
Mm-hmm. Who else is part of that original San Francisco?
Dana Carvey. I mean,
Carvey's up there.
Yeah,
right?
And you heard about the San Francisco International Stand-Up Comedy Competition?
No.
Okay, so that's a thing in San Francisco, and I think it thrives to this day. And all the almost all a lot of the big name comedians came through that competition. Many of which started in San Francisco.
Steve Martin was up there for a while.
Steve was there. He recorded "Let's Get Small," his first comedy album at the Boarding House. Where a couple of nights ago, because there's a thing called San Francisco Sketch Fest or SF Sketch Fest, where you should do this podcast from someday if you want, because they do it in big theaters and people come out. I saw John Glazer, who I love, perform on that same stage, which is now Cobb's Comedy Club. But it was the Boarding House back in the 70s when – I think it was the 70s when he did Let's Get Small, pretty sure.
And, so
yeah,
so
it's definitely the 70s.
This segue into acting – This is the pivot that I'm fascinated with you.
Well, it might have started in front of the furniture because I was acting as if I were a grown man comedian.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't myself, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then when I started doing impersonations, I wasn't myself, and I was inhabiting and embodying the gestures and cadence and line readings of geniuses, right? Be it Albert Brooks, be it Alan Arkin, you know. And so I learned, like, I insist to this day, when I impersonate Albert Brooks, I think faster and funnier than I do as myself. Do you want to interview Albert Brooks for a minute?
Sure.
All right, let's
do it. Albert, it's nice to see you, my friend.
First of all, what kind of a name is Spike?
Well, that's it's a nickname.
Yeah. Well, okay. Does anyone know your actual name? Can I guess it?
Sure, go
ahead. Give me a multiple choice. Would
okay,
you do that for
ahead.
Me? Give me four names.
Yep.
And I'll come within one name of being correct.
Okay. It's either A, David, B, Eric, C, Michael, or D, Tom.
Okay, it's definitely not Tom.
Why?
Because you searched for it. You have a tell. I'm going to be a detective right now.
Okay.
In fact, you threw out David so fast.
Right.
I have an inclination to think it was David.
Right.
Because your imagination just stopped. And
yes.
You said, I'll give him the real name first.
Right.
And then I can't do that.
That's good. That was fantastic. But you know my real name's Michael.
I think everyone knows that.
Oh, okay. Really?
Sure.
I doubt it. All right.
Well, first of all, not everyone knows you.
Not everybody even knows me.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Did you know Jerry, right? You've done stand-up with Jerry. Are you part of that seminal group of the Leno, the Seinfeld, those early stand-up
so
guys
they would,
who invented it?
Each of them would come through San Francisco, and I would open up for them.
Mm-hmm.
So when I did that, they saw something they liked, and they each said, Leno, Reiser, Seinfeld, Shandling. They said, when you come to Los Angeles, let me know, and I'll make sure you get stage time.
Wow.
You know? And so when I did come to Los Angeles, they made sure I got stage time. It was really at the Improv. That was the room.
Right.
And then I would go to their Tonight Show appearances, right? And I would go with Seinfeld, and I would go with Paul, and I would go with Jerry Seinfeld, and Shandling too, and so.
And that, what was that like? I mean, well, you're standing in the wings, you're watching
all,
these guys on this show, right?
You're backstage in their dressing room,
yeah,
right? So you don't see Carson beforehand,
no.
But you see Jim McCauley, the famed gatekeeper. If you follow comedy, specifically comedians who still insist on talking about The Tonight Show.
Yes.
As if it were Valhalla, because it was. but it just ages us so instantly. It's,
right.
It's kind of crazy.
No, it's not. It's about ambition. I always key in on this, these moments of ambition, these moments where you pop and how it happens. And so many people, I'm sure, reach out to you as they reach out to me and go, how do you do this? How do you get found? And,
yeah.
You know, I love, you know, everything I'm hearing is so amazing. Like the idea that Jerry and these guys are gracious. I've always noticed that in stand-up. They help other people out, but they bring you to L.A., right? And now you're the big fish in the little pond in San Francisco.
That's
and you
exactly
come here,
right. Yeah.
And you're like,
starting
oh, my God,
over.
There's you're starting over.
Yeah.
And then they walk you into this sacred place that can make your career,
and they
right?
They say
make
to Bud Friedman, the next gatekeeper, put
yep.
this kid on.
And that's what they do,
and Bud
right?
looks through you like you're a ghost. And
right.
eventually he puts you on.
But when you get to that Tonight Show and you're there and you meet the gatekeeper.
Jim McCauley. So
are you feeling jealous? Like, God, I got to.
Well, initially, no. Initially, you are the first child that ever walked into a candy store. And you
right.
cannot believe
right.
you're backstage at the Tonight Show. I mean, you just can't.
Right.
You can't believe you're in show business.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
I felt the same way when I went to Saturday Night Live as an intern.
Of course.
I could not believe I was here
at
30
a,
Rock walking
very,
up there. Right.
It's a great analogy for this because that's the same feeling.
Right.
When it's an institution of that size, then you just – what? And then,
but look at the connections you've just made in that single moment.
Well, so it paid off huge because I got to know Jim McCauley as in that milieu first.
Right.
Right? So that when I eventually bumped into him in the – outer dining area at the Improv in Los Angeles. I said, hey, Jim, how's it going? You know, it was that. Whereas everyone else, all the other comedians were so intimidated by this guy.
Right.
So for the listeners that don't know, Jim McCauley was the segment producer but the talent coordinator for stand-up comedians, as in he had to find new stand-up comedians to go on The Tonight Show. And Johnny was a great fan of stand-up, and there's
mm-hmm.
legendary stories of who he spontaneously paneled. There's only a handful of people. If he gave you the okay sign after your set, it meant you were coming back. If he just applauded, you were dead in the water. But McCauley had to circle acts,
mm-hmm.
we would call it. He had to circle an act for a while to make sure not only you were ready for The Tonight Show, that you had a tight 6 minutes.
And what does that mean? Would he come to the clubs?
Yeah. Yeah, all the time. All the time. And so he had to make sure, I eventually learned, not only did you have a tight 6 minutes that you could do on the show,
right.
and he would work with you on it because he knew what Johnny liked, or so goes his version. But he had to make sure you had two segments prepared because he knew if you killed that first time, Johnny would say, that kid was great. Bring him back right away. That kid was fantastic.
And what was that time period the next time? Like if he came back that second time,
well,
was it a month later? Or
no,
was it
sometimes it was a week later. So the point was
– A week?
McCauley had to make sure you had two shots ready.
Wow.
Yeah. It was rare that someone came back a week later, but it happened. And if it happens once, like if McCauley picks the wrong comedian, then Johnny would rip off his head and shit down his neck.
Right,
I
right.
mean, that was also McCauley lived in fear of Johnny, and we all lived in fear of McCauley.
Right.
Right? So I walked through one night after knowing him the way I explained, and I said, hey, Jim, how's it going? Who are you here to see tonight? Because he was always there to see someone. And he said, well, the person I was here to see, I just saw on the list canceled. So I saw your name on the list. I'm going to stick around and watch your set because I think you might be ready for the show. And what came out of my mouth next had not been rehearsed. It had not even been thought.
Mm-hmm.
It's important for you to know that. I said, well, Jim, I'm not going to lie. I've been pretty much waiting since the age of 10 for this to happen. this exact moment. I've been a fan of the show since I was 10. My parents let me watch. I know everything about the inner workings of the show, as you know, backstage as well. And I know that although I've waited my entire life to do stand-up on the show, watching my heroes and Albert Brooks and Steve Martin and Don Rickles, do their stand-up act from the couch in the guise of a conversation. I think that's where I'll kill most because of the impersonations and because Johnny does impersonations himself. And I think if I sit next to him and do an impersonation in a conversational story, that's where I'll kill. Now, and Jim's just staring at me, and I say, now, I understand also well enough to know that there's a protocol, that you cannot bring me to the couch unless I have a movie out or a TV show out, and you can bring me out in that world, and then I can do the impressions. And so what I'm saying is I think I'm willing to wait until I have a TV show or a movie out where you can bring me right to the couch, because that will be life-changing. And he stared at me as if I just stepped off an alien ship. And I instantly started feeling like an asshole for saying it. But again, mm-hmm. it was really coming from a pure deconstruction of what the show is and what it could be for me,
mm-hmm.
more so than what the obvious –
what they needed.
What it seems like.
For that night's show.
Yeah. So he stared at me a bit and then he said, do you have a TV show or a movie coming out anytime soon? And what I did not tell him was that I did not even have an agent. I didn't even have any auditions at that point. And I just said, no, but I'm look, Jim, I may call you back in an hour and if you give me a number and beg for the opportunity you just offered me. But he said, no, you're not wrong. You will have a greater impact from that couch.
Right.
I've seen your act. You will absolutely have a greater impact from the couch. And you're also right that I'm not going to bring you on the show until you have a TV show or a movie in that capacity.
Mm-hmm.
But you're only going to get better, so if you want to wait, let's see how long you can wait. It's fine with me. If you want to wait, just let me know, you know. And so I didn't tell anyone that I had this conversation.
Wow.
I didn't tell my circle of comedian friends.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't tell anyone for fear that they would say part of my thought process at that point, which was, you're an asshole.
Yes.
Go say yes.
Right.
What is the matter with you?
Right, which sometimes we need. We need this little push.
Yeah, well,
what did you do?
I had a singular idea. I actually saw myself, because again, it was almost Rupert Pupkin in my sense of of fandom of that show from Scorsese's King of Comedy. I hadn't built a set in my basement because it's California. There's not a lot of basements, but I envisioned myself on that show sitting there the way my heroes had and making Johnny also. In my stand-up now, after doing impersonations for almost 40 years in my stand-up act, I've figured out a way to deconstruct the art of the impersonation in my stand-up act, and which is basically, if I can think of someone you like,
yes,
and I can recreate them in front of you,
yep,
I'll steal the affection you feel towards that person.
Right.
I mean, it's ridiculous. It's okay. Actually a parlor trick. So if I cross one eye and I say, geez, I hate to bother you. I don't mean to be a pest. If you like Peter Falk, I own you.
Right.
Not because I'm crossing my eye, a little bit because I'm crossing my eye, which is naturally funny, and a little bit because the voice sounds like him. But a lot of it, if not the majority, is because who doesn't love Peter Falk?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I knew Carson loved Peter Falk because, again, as a student of the show, I saw he had Peter Falk on all the time.
He did.
All the time.
Yeah.
Maybe not as many times as Burt Reynolds, but a lot. And Peter made him laugh like crazy, which is one of the reasons Peter becomes more endearing.
Right.
And I want to watch Columbo more because Carson loses his mind when Peter Falk's on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that if I sat on that couch and I did Peter Falk for Carson, I would own him the way Peter did.
Mm-hmm.
I just knew it because it was based on experience, mm-hmm. like the one I just had with you.
Yep.
I knew what it was like to do someone's voice and face and demeanor in front of another person or an audience and have them lose their minds. It was like juggling. It was a parlor trick. And it took me 35 years to deconstruct it and bust myself on what it actually is. But I knew it would happen. So it took my memory is a little sketchy, but it took well over a year.
Maybe, the moment he asked you.
Yes. And I would see him many times after.
Really?
Either backstage with somebody.
Wow.
Because, and if I'm also brutally honest, there was a little bit of fear, and I was protecting myself.
Right. I understand that.
From not being the greatest stand-up comedian of all time.
Mm-hmm.
versus holy crap, did you see Pollock on the couch last night?
Yeah.
And so I knew that there could be a potential chasm between those two performances.
Right, right.
So there was a little, if I'm now old enough to be brutally honest to myself and your listeners, there was a protective element as well.
But weren't you worried that the opportunity would go away? I mean, you know how it is in this business.
I don't know.
Someone asks you something on a Monday, Tuesday, that opportunity is gone. You just thought.
Mid-20s, fearless.
I'm going to take this guy for his word. The opportunity will always be there.
Yeah, I had gone in on a few auditions because people would come to the improv, casting directors, and Barry Levinson himself, who would eventually cast me in Avalon and, in fact, change my the trajectory of my career.
Well, I liked Willow, too.
Well, Willow was the movie.
But wait, let's go
Willow
back.
Was the movie that got me on The Tonight Show.
It is.
It is.
So that's the first moment you're on.
Yep.
Willow, if you guys haven't seen Willow. I just went back and watched the trailer and remembered how much I loved that movie.
It's on
how
Disney.
Much I loved Avalon.
It's on Disney Plus right now.
It is?
For you, Willow is.
Yeah.
This way! that's pretty much what I did
in
the film.
It's such a charming little movie.
It's
such
pretty
a
sweet.
Wonderful little movie. And
so I got Willow and I called Macaulay and he had me on the show and he says, what's the first question you want Johnny to ask you? Because you know there's a pre-interview.
Right.
And I said, just have him say, I understand you do impersonations. And I will launch into Peter Falk. And Jim, it'll be over.
And that was it.
And he said, he laughed and said, okay.
So you didn't go out, you never did traditional stand-up on the show? Or you,
No.
It was always...
It was like 15, 16 months.
Wow.
And, you know, I'm standing behind the curtain that night. Macaulay's the one who pulls the curtain back for you to walk through.
Mm-hmm.
That curtain that I had seen all my heroes come through.
Mm-hmm.
So I rehearsed it, walking through the curtain before I got there that night. And I thought, do I wave to Doc in the band? And I thought, no, you don't do that as a first guy.
No.
First time on?
No, you don't.
No, don't be that asshole. Get to Johnny.
Did you, at any time, did you think I should dance like they do now as they walk onto the late night stages?
Oh, God, no.
No, right?
Of
what's
course
all, what's
not.
With all the dancing that goes on these days?
No. No.
It's not right.
It's worse than it's not right. Yeah, no one asked you to be there to watch you dance.
You're right.
Yeah.
But there is a long, you know, most people don't get to do that, and they don't understand that geography, that space, that walk is long. It's short, but it's a long walk, and you start to overthink it. Unless you have your brain.
If you're there as an audience member, it's a lot shorter than you thought it was.
Yes.
If you're there as the performer, you're right. It's a mile.
It's a marathon, and you're like, how do I handle this?
Well,
And most people don't know the answer to that. They think, I'll dance.
Get to Johnny.
I'll wave to Doc.
To Johnny. So I said, I'll wave to Doc my second time on.
Yes. Okay.
Because then I've been on already.
Yep.
Right?
That's exactly right.
And Carson will say, we're excited to have him back. And the audience will say, oh, back. Oh, he's been here before. Mm-hmm. And then it's okay if I wave at Doc.
Yes.
So I don't wave at Doc. I go, he's coming back from commercial. Ladies and gentlemen, my next guest is an actor, and I'm also told he's a comedian. He's got a new movie out called Willow. Please welcome Kevin Pollak. And I walk through that curtain, and I get the hell over to Johnny, and we sit down, and he says, now we'll talk about Willow in just a second, Kevin, the movie directed by Ron Howard. But somebody told me you do impersonations. Is that right? And without missing a beat, I cross the eye. Like Peter Falk, I raised one hand the way Columbo did, and I said, Johnny, that's a bold-faced lie. I don't know who told you that. And it was one of those laughs where he pushed himself away from the desk, and he's clutching his chest.
And what are you feeling at that moment then? Are you staying in the act, or are you like,
I imagine I just landed the most important joke. It's as big as any moment's ever been. It's bigger.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as big as when my high school mate, I was thinking of using this as a parallel analogy, but it's not quite as big. I went to high school with Dave Rigetti, who was a great pitching coach for the San Francisco Giants, where I'm from, and he pitched a no-hitter his rookie year on 4th of July.
Wow.
Not quite as big as that, but but the feeling he must have had, right, was definitely how I felt.
Wow.
Because in my chosen profession, I had just pitched a no-hitter.
Yeah, you
did. I just hit a grand slam in the World Series. Because I had formulated this ridiculous notion that this would happen. I was overly confident that it would go great because enough audiences and people individually had told me that my Peter Falk was ridiculously good. So I had every reason to think this would happen. I'd done the math. right? It was a logic problem. And the problem was solved. And so when Carson – I didn't expect him to push himself away from the desk and clutch his chest in laughter, which I'd seen. I thought he would laugh very, very hard. But when he pushed himself away from the desk and clutched his chest, which I will continue to say, I thought also in that moment, I'll be back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he had me back.
That's an exciting story.
3 to 4 times a year until he retired. I mean, it was – he couldn't get enough.
He just loved impressions.
Yeah. He really, really did.
Did you start to run out of impressions?
Well.
Did you go, geez, now I've got to refill this thing for Johnny Carson?
Well,
and
so.
And it can't be half-assed.
I always, from an early age or early doing impersonations, thought, although Rich Little's my hero when I first started.
Rich Little was?
Well, because he was the number one guy.
Mm-hmm.
But I did notice right away that Rich Little was not funny.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure he would know funny if you hit him in the face with a comedy show.
Yet we loved him.
Yet we loved him because, this proves my deconstruction point. Mm-hmm. His impressions were so great that he mm-hmm. was able to conjure up. In fact,
I also liked his name. I just liked, when I was a kid, the name Rich Little.
Yeah.
Because I was little.
Well, there you go. Me too. And Dana Carvey too. In fact, Dana mm-hmm. will confess the reason I'm thinking of him is that he and I learned our Johnny Carson impersonation from Rich Little.
Ah.
That's the thing. You always mm-hmm. get it from someone. Like we learned Nixon from David Fry, guy who had a comedy album out.
I worked with Dana on SNL, and I worked with him on a pilot that we did for Fox that was a sketch comedy pilot. And, you know, I said to him one day, we were both starring in it. I said, this isn't what I do. I don't know why I'm in this. And he, every week, would teach me a little thing about impressions and doing sketch. And it was fascinating. And then I was thinking back to when I was an intern on SNL with him. And he would say, I have to play someone this week, get me some tape. And he'd look for, you know, this little tick they had
yes.
and this little voice thing they had. And then he would turn the volume up to 10 on those things.
That became his genius.
And that's how he started the character.
Yeah.
He exaggerated it a lot.
But
he found two or three things.
He would find the key. There was always a key.
Right, right.
Bush became not gagged at. You know,
yeah.
They weren't even words.
Exactly.
I remember being on the phone with him when it was like a Tuesday, and I said, who they got you doing this week? And he said, Ross Perot. And we'd only seen Ross Perot on Larry King. We didn't really know much about Ross Perot
right.
at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Ross Perot, how are you going to do Ross Perot?
Mm-hmm.
He said, I don't know. They got me a tape of him on Larry King. I'm going to watch it.
Right.
And then we both just started riffing what he was like from the Larry King appearance we had both seen.
Mm-hmm.
We started riffing the impression on the phone, and by the end of the call, we both had a perfect Ross Perot. And I said, well, this sucks because at the end of the week, you're going to become famous for doing Ross Perot.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just going to be some asshole who's doing Dana Carvey's Ross Perot.
That's right.
Because we had nailed it on the phone.
Yes.
The key he found was, Larry, can I finish? Can I finish, Larry? Larry, can I finish?
Yeah.
And mine was to mock how Ross Perot had an analogy for everything, and it never made sense. And I would say, the economy is like peanut butter, see? If you feed it to a horse and he chews on it, it'll look like he's talking.
There you go.
Yeah.
He had me doing it within like 2 weeks. I was so impressed. He made it so easy.
Yeah.
I was watching one of those clips the other day, and I was like, God, I was actually pretty decent in that thing. And it was all Dana, you know?
Yeah.
Taught me more, I think, in 2 weeks of production than I had learned in entertainment the whole time. We got to have him on. He's great. Do you see him up there? He's up in Marin County, isn't he?
He's here a lot.
Last time I spoke to him, he had some setup in his house where he had a studio and a bunch of his friends coming over, and they would just make weird videos that they would just put out to each other.
Was that like a year or more ago?
Yeah.
He's here a lot more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
I will text him and let him know you're looking for him.
Yeah.
You can text him.
I will.
Yeah.
I said, Dana, why aren't you making that a show? That sounds fascinating. So you've got a control room in your house?
Yeah.
And you've got comedy writers and cameras and you're editing videos?
Yeah.
Why isn't that a show? Why isn't that its own YouTube channel?
Yeah.
Amazing guy.
What's up, Brian Deegan here. I'm excited to bring you our podcast, The Deegans, that will be every Wednesday on Podcast One and Apple Podcasts. We'll be covering many subjects such as racing, family, how we stay together, how we thrive as a family. So I think it's exciting. We're going to cover all those subjects and many more.
Be sure you guys check out our new podcast, The Deegans, airing every Wednesday on Podcast One and on Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review.
You're listening to Spike's Car Radio.
I want to talk about these movies.
Should we talk about a car at some point?
Well,
you don't have to.
You know what? It's a car and a comedy podcast. If you're a car guy and you really want to get into that, we can do it. What do you drive?
Well, I would like to know your take on the Tesla Model S. I'm on my third, and I've been on the teat since they first rolled off.
Okay. Well, what does my take matter? It sounds like you like them, right?
It's a spaceship.
And you enjoy it, and it's good for the environment.
It will also take off the line almost any streetcar made.
Yes.
Because
maybe
it doesn't have a combustion drag, as you know.
Right.
So, obviously, if you know how to drive a car with a combustion drag, you know how to get off the line. But, you know, 2.8, 0 to 60,
yeah,
is that a thing?
Yeah, the ludicrous mode, the fast one, yeah.
I don't.
Well, you know, I don't put much stock in any of the 0 to 60s or the top speeds anyway. I don't know. Are you interested in doing an Elon Musk impression?
That would make you happy.
That would make me happy.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he seems to have lost his mind, yet he's got this incredible career and company. But
I don't know that
also,
he lost it. I think he was always gone. I think everything you say is going to get you in trouble. I think he's that genius that's just shy of the so-called spectrum.
Right.
And
right.
I think that level of genius comes with that.
Right, right.
And
right.
They're not socially comfortable.
Right.
And as much as I'm struggling right now trying to make sure I don't say the wrong thing, imagine, you know, that there's no editor and there's no what will people think of me? That version of the spectrum.
Right.
Right. So he ends up saying and doing a lot of things that it's their emperor's clothing now. No one's in a circle saying, maybe not. Maybe don't right. wear that and
right.
say that.
Right.
And I think that leads to –
But you like the Tesla. You're on your third
one. Yeah.
Aren't
yeah.
you ready for a new exterior look?
But I grew up, my first car was the Austin Healey Sprite.
Wow.
That's a cool car. The Chevy Malibu. I grew up with kind of motor cars.
Yeah.
You know, I remember.
Did your dad have nice cars?
He's not a car guy. So, but I do remember he had the Volkswagen Bug when it rolled off.
Really?
The assembly. And we.
We're in Germany?
We at that point rolled off in California.
Okay.
When I know you guys go to Germany to get your car, so that was the wrong thing to say.
When it rolled off where it begins.
Well, when it first started.
Yeah, that's first back when the Hitler days.
First hit the States.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
After that.
Well, again, we were California Jews. We
yes.
could forgive a lot of things. But I do remember at that point we had moved down to the promise of the suburbs of San Jose, about an hour south of San Francisco, when there was a walnut orchard at the end of the street, not
right.
Silicon Valley at the end of the street. And we were going to all pile in the car. I must have been 8, 9 years old. My brother's 2 years older. The four, a family of four, into the little Volkswagen Bug. We
wow.
drove to San Francisco to see the hippies on Haight-Ashbury,
mm-hmm.
like we were going to Africa Safari. Yeah.
So why were your parents interested in seeing hippies?
Well, because in San Francisco was the birth of the hippie.
Right.
And they had taken over the Haight-Ashbury intersection
yeah.
and a good part of the street.
So, but what was the
I'm
conversation
not kidding.
With your,
it
your parents? Let's go see hippies today?
Yeah, well, let's go see what's happening in San Francisco.
Were they enlightened? Were they like, this is interesting to us? Or were they like...
They didn't share that much. They just were fascinated by the news, I'm sure.
And
it was only an hour away. And I think,
right.
by the way, think about it in terms of, you know, you said you have kids 9 and 11.
Yeah.
So imagine taking them to a social awakening.
Yeah.
The beginning of a culture and an mm-hmm. era.
My wife does this all the time with my boys.
Right.
But that's
so,
different. But she's part of it, right? But I think what you're saying
she's
is
dialed
like,
in. My parents were not dialed in.
My mom would say things occasionally when we were young, like the homosexuals. You know, I enjoy driving through that part of town because I get to see the homosexuals.
Sure. Yeah. Well, in 67, they definitely spoke like that. Yeah,
interesting.
Yeah. So the homosexuals in this case were the hippies.
The hippies.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's the only way you would actually get, you know, see what the other people are like. There's no internet. There's no anything else.
They took them. Took pride themselves in being called freaks.
Yes.
So
but the parents never decided, let's be hippies ourselves.
Oh, gosh, no.
No.
In fact, when we went and we're driving down the street, it was bumper to bumper like an African safari. And I remember the car behind us was a Rolls Royce.
Right.
And it kept bumping into my dad's bug and he was losing his mind.
Pushing it, hitting it.
Just barely tapping it. You know, this giant tank of a rich man's car.
Wow.
And my dad was, get off my ass! You know,
right, screaming.
It was
but
hilarious.
You all had your windows. Were you throwing peanuts to the hippies?
Oh, the windows were up.
What?
Windows were up.
I'm telling you,
this was an African safari. For sure. These were wild animals.
Did hippies jump onto the cars?
They
like
might.
Wild animals?
They might. We don't know.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so interesting.
Also, we're not going to get that marijuana smoke inside the car, so keep
right,
the windows
right.
up.
Yeah, yeah, that would be bad. And was the clothing really that different than what was going on anywhere else? Like when you saw a hippie, it was completely...
I don't even know if there's an analogy to express how different it was.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is really funny.
You remember the first time you saw Devo?
No. Yeah, I do.
Okay. Do you remember
right.
thinking... What are they wearing?
This was Devo?
Well, no, just thinking, what
yeah,
are they
what's
wearing?
On their head?
What are they wearing?
Yeah.
And why? That's the feeling.
What's
that was
with
the feeling.
Glasses?
That was the
what
feeling.
What is this music?
Yeah. The hippies yeah. weren't dressed like Devo, but the analogy is,
I love
what
Devo.
The hell are they wearing?
All right.
So the acting was just, casting directors would come in, and then everyone tells a young comedian.
But were you a trained actor? Did you learn how to act? That's what I've been meaning to ask.
I'm embarrassed to say there's no formal training.
No formal training. You yeah. just, it sounds like you had it since you were 10. And you have no problem, I guess you don't, remembering the scripts and the lines and the...
No, that's a weird thing that was. I didn't know it was there until I tapped into it. And to this day, even at my ripe age of, do you want to guess? Well, I keep referencing.
You're a little older than me, but not much.
Well, I keep saying 10 and 60. 67, so I'm 62.
62. You're a spry young man. Look at you. And you're younger than Seinfeld.
And I'm always going to be younger than Seinfeld.
So, all right, let's talk about Rob Reiner, who used to be, maybe he's still in this building.
He was forever.
And A Few Good
yeah,
Men.
Yeah, Castle Rock was Maple Drive.
Did you audition for any of these films? Did you go in and read for them, or did you just get cast?
In the case, well...
A Few Good Men, let's stick with it.
Yeah, Willow was the starting point.
Okay.
And I had done one little tiny movie, Dino De Laurentiis... decided to rip off It's a Mad, 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 Mad World and do a movie starring stand-up comedians trying to find hidden money.
Mm-hmm.
Complete ripoff.
Yep.
Not a reimagining, a ripoff.
Mm-hmm.
And so Rick Overton was in that movie as well as I. And so then when Rick Overton was cast in Willow as one of the Brownies, Ron Howard and he had known each other and had done, I think, Gung Ho or some movie together before that. And Ron said, well, I'm going to need you to improvise with whoever plays the other Brownie a lot. So is there anyone that you could suggest? Pick 3, 4, 5 guys. I'll have them each come in one at a time, and they'll improvise with you in an audition setting.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll know. And that's how I got Willow.
Wow.
Because Rick Overton suggested me, and we improvised together, and off we went.
How long of an improvisation did you do? And how many people were in the room? Was it Ron Howard? You've got Opie sitting there, and you've got how many people, and you come in.
You know, I never feel the number 62 until this exact sort of moment when I'm asked very specifics of a very
were
important
were they rolling
moment.
Tape? Were you nervous?
I can't picture anything in the
did
room.
Did you know what he was going to throw at you to start the whole thing off? You don't remember any
I
of it.
I can't picture anything.
See, I would fail so badly in this situation. I would fail.
In that situation?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, listen.
I wouldn't get Willow. I wouldn't get it like you.
Rick Overton would not have suggested me if we didn't already
you guys
have been playing.
But it's different when you're sitting there and,
in fact,
know.
When we were doing Willow in San Rafael, just above San Francisco, we would drop down to the city to do shows, and we would call Robin Williams, who was hanging around, and he would come, and the three of us would improvise on stage together.
Wow.
Yeah. So improv has always been in my quiver, as
mm-hmm.
it were. And only recently, since I have your listeners, did I decide to do an all-improvised comedy podcast with some brilliant improvisers that I've handpicked.
Right, right.
It's called Alchemy This. And I would encourage your listeners to give it a sample if they need
all of it.
If they need a comedy break from
yes.
From everything else.
I want to get we have to but, promote all the stuff you're promoting here too.
Oh no!
But I want to ask you about A Few Good Men.
Oh geez, I've gone too long, and we're already almost.
You
done.
Haven't gone too long.
We're almost done.
There's no time limit.
Well, there is for me.
Yes, and me too. I've got a 10:15.
Of course, there
I got to hop in a call. But A Few Good Men.
whatever you want to know. So I
you're
have
on,
done.
You're Rob Reiner. Let's skip past. You get the part.
Rob Reiner. Yeah, I got the part. Rob Reiner and Christopher Guest created a little show called originally Partners in Life, and it became what was the new name? Morton and Hayes.
Mm-hmm.
Chick Morton and Eddie Hayes. These mm-hmm. two, the comedy team from the 30s. It was. Everyone
don't know
auditioned
about
for this thing.
One.
So I got that. It was a summer series. Nobody saw it. But I was in Rob Reiner's face every day working on it because he directed. And one day at lunch, he waved his beautifully stubby finger in my face and said, the next movie I'm doing is called A Few Good Men. It was a Broadway play. I got Tom Cruise.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm going to get Jack Nicholson. But there's
wow.
a part as Tom's co-counsel that you're perfect for. I have an offer out to Jason Alexander. But if Seinfeld gets picked up for a second season, which Castle Rock produced, Rob's company.
Which, by the way,
company.
We don't think is happening at that point.
Not season two.
Yeah.
No,
so
it's on Fridays.
Yeah, yeah.
They
it's
did
not
the
working.
Seinfeld Chronicles.
Right.
They did four episodes only.
Yep.
And it tanked.
Yep.
So there was no season
so
two.
You're thinking, all right, whatever, I'm not getting
so that's
this one.
Not happening.
Right.
But I did go home and start praying for Jason Alexander's success. And it worked out pretty well for both of us.
It did.
Yeah.
It's always the right thing to do.
Yeah. So there was that moment, and then there was...
So you get cast in the movie, and now you're in scenes with Tom Cruise. What is Tom Cruise like at that point?
From the second I arrive at rehearsal,
yeah.
I'm treated like an equal.
I mean
as if...
Is he as big at that moment as he is right now?
Oh, yeah. No, after Top Gun, it's over.
Right. So that's post-Top Gun Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
Big dude. Do you get nervous? Are you going to be able to work
Not
in a scene with him?
Not only am I nervous, I think, oh, so this is the movie that I'm found out. That I am a comedian with no formal training.
Right.
Because this was a Broadway play.
Right.
There would be no improvising.
Mm-hmm.
Rob wanted to stick to the script. He worked with Aaron Sorkin, who wrote the play and now the screenplay, to change a couple of things. Because in the play, they give away that Nicholson's character, Colonel Jessup, I from what I'm told, I've only seen the play and it was a long, long time ago. I barely remember. But one of the big changes was Colonel Jessup is truly insane from the moment you meet him, so much so
mm-hmm.
that there's no question you're going to get him, trip him up on the stand later. It's just a matter of getting him there. If you can
mm-hmm.
just land the fish, so I'm at rehearsal and Tom Cruise treats me like an equal, which it wasn't just like being a professional or being gregarious, both of which he was and is. It really was his work ethic that every I assume time he starts a film, let's roll up our sleeves, we're in this together. And to this day, we shared a foxhole in Nam. I mean, it's I got your back no matter what. It's kind of uncanny.
Wow.
Yeah. And Demi Moore, too, who was a giant star at that point. In fact, are you a baseball guy at all?
Yeah.
So Rob is a huge baseball guy, Rob Reiner, and he said to me, look, Jack's going to hit a grand slam just when he walks through the door.
right.
He shows up, he's Babe Ruth.
Uh-huh.
So that means Tom's going to have to swing for the fences every time at the
mm-hmm.
park just to keep up, to go toe-to-toe. That's the movie. That's what people are coming to see. So Demi is going to be swinging just as hard. I need you to hit one into the gap, maybe bring in a run. You know, I need you to be the utility player.
Yeah.
Who the ball comes to you, I know it's going to happen.
Right. When does he tell you this? Before the movie?
During rehearsal.
During rehearsal.
Yeah. Because okay. I really am out of my element. I mean, that was the eighth film. I had died in Denzel Washington's arms in Ricochet.
Mm-hmm.
I had done Avalon surrounded by brilliant stage actors and somehow held my own. And the no formal training. So I remember I went to J.T. Welch's trailer on the set of A Few Good Men. He played Markinson. Spoiler alert from 27 years ago. He's the character that kills himself
mm-hmm.
With his revolver. He works Nicholson's right-hand man. He's a great character actor out of Chicago, a lot of Mamet movies. J.T. Welch, brilliant. And I confess to him in his trailer, I don't know what I'm doing. This is the movie I'm found out
wow,
on.
Wow, so you're panicking.
What am I going to do?
Yeah.
And he said, we'd already been shooting for a couple of weeks. And he said, you're already doing a style of acting that people train their whole lives to learn. I don't know where you got it from. If this were a sports situation, you'd be what they call a natural. But then the technique is called less is more. It's what you're doing. You're doing
right.
less is more.
Yeah.
He said there's a second half of that. Less is more. Nothing is best. If you can do nothing and be interesting, you win.
Wilford Brimley does that really well.
That's right. And I've made a career out of doing nothing.
There it is.
But until The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which I'm sure you haven't seen.
Now that's very different.
But you know people who have seen it.
I've watched every episode.
I'm a loud, obnoxious Jew. And it's bizarre that I've never.
Who gets up at 4:30 in the morning? And my wife stops it. Do you see Spike? He gets up at 4:30 in the morning like I get up at 4:30 in the morning. Mm-hmm. Can you believe they just did a run on 4:30 in the morning? Stop giving me shit about getting up at 4:30 in the morning because he gets up at 4:30 in the morning.
I love that you had that moment.
I yelled at because of that.
I had to tell stupid Carson stories. It took 45 minutes to get that out of you. I assume you'd never seen an episode. But I'm playing. Did you see Avalon?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm channeling Lou Jacoby from Avalon, the guy who yells, you cut the turkey without me.
No.
Because I'd never played a loud, obnoxious character who's a blowhard who never stops talking.
There's a guy named Rocco who comes to Bill's Malibu Kitchen where we have coffee, Jerry and I and the gang. And he came in one day and he goes, have you seen Mrs. Maisel? And I went, what? Who's that? And I'm looking out in the porch. And he goes, no, it's a show. It's on Amazon. He goes, it's a gift. Just watch it. It's
and
a
gift.
And
who is this guy?
Rocco DiSpirito, I think, is his last name. He's a producer, comedy producer, right? He's just part
familiar.
Of the. It's an interesting gang down there, right? Everybody from Chuck Lorre to you'll see a lot of folks down there,
you
and
just
they go, "Oh yeah,
me.
That's the guy who drove O.J. Simpson in the White Bronco." But it's mostly just people having coffee. So Rocco says, and I don't know Rocco that well. Nice enough guy, but I know him as Rocco. It's a gift. You got to watch. It's a gift. I went home that night, Saturday night, put it on with my wife, and there it is. It's a gift.
So thank you. Thank
it you. Becomes this beautiful show. She now, on Saturday, you know, as you know, co-viewing can be difficult. We both find things, but I find this show, it's funny in a lot of different ways. It reminds me of Seinfeld in a lot of ways. It's the writing's clever. The acting is great. The scenery, the wardrobe, everything's beautiful about it, right? The whole thing works.
Choreographed.
All of you guys are fantastic. You're elevating the writing in ways that they're completely unexpected. And I'm having a nice time with my wife watching the stories, right? And it's that, you know, remember when Neil Simon said, write Yiddish, cast British?
Wow.
This is write Yiddish, cast Yiddish, right?
Half the cast is not Jewish.
Right, but they play.
Tony Shalhoub, Lebanese, natural born enemy.
And you and Shalhoub, those scenes are fantastic. They're fantastic as an old man myself.
But,
I love watching your old man scenes together. And now that you're living together in the house.
See, that's how brilliant of an actor Tony Shalhoub is. Tony Award winner. He's an actual actor who plays Jewish beautifully.
Right.
I'm just channeling old Jews that I had in my family.
Right. No, but it's fun. You're his foil, and you're the one who gets him upset, and your relationship with your son is great. I mean, and never for a moment do I see Kevin Pollak. I see the character, and it's, you know, you're really great at it. And it's rare in TV these days, right? And now I'm going to see Kevin Pollak. Now I know you.
Sure.
But you're so good at playing that character, and it's so different than anything else I've ever, you know, seen you play.
Well, as a writer yourself, I myself a proud member of the WGA since 1987.
Yes, sir.
You know that any actor is only as good as the material that they then can lift and make better, as you suggested. But if you don't have great writing to start with, your role and your job can sometimes be impossible.
Your wife in that same episode who's playing the TV loud, I don't know the actress who plays your wife.
Caroline Aaron.
So funny. Her disruption.
She's brilliant.
And again, it's entered my house. I walked down. I'm working on a script right now, and I came down from my office, and the kitchen was loud. And I go, oh, what? This is the thing we were just laughing at, and now you're doing it. You're doing it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a testament to the show that it enters real life, right? It enters our lives, and it affects us that way. And my wife really does get up at 4:30 and makes me absolutely crazy. But you're not here to promote Maisel?
The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, or is my friend Bobby Slayton. You know Bobby Slayton, the comedian?
I don't. I know the
name.
You
know of him?
Yes.
He would say, Pollock, I love the show. Yeah, it's the amazing Mrs. Matza.
Right. Steinfeld is what we heard. Steinfeld.
Well, Rob Reiner yelled at Jerry about his name.
Why?
Steinfeld's not a name. It's either Steinfeld or it's something else. But he always loved to yell at Jerry.
Did he want him to get rid of it?
That's not actually a name. Oh, he wasn't yelling at him to change it in any way. He was just trying to be funny.
I feel like I'm in the same boat with Ferriston. I mean, there are no other Ferristons in the world.
Well,
this weird change.
Your father or grandfather?
My grandfather, Morris.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's misspelled everywhere. Sure. It's never spelled correctly.
I have to spell my last name by saying there's no C.
Pollock is nice.
There's no C.
It's got a nice ring. Kevin Pollock.
It's interesting because at 11, I went to my mom and said, Pollock's clunky, and I'd like to be called Kevin Klein.
Right.
At 11. There was no famous Kevin Klein yet.
There wasn't.
Her maiden name was Klein.
Wow.
And I said, I'm going to go with Kevin Klein.
Is that one of your biggest regrets, that you could have been Kevin Klein?
Just for the Phoebe Cates of it all.
Yes. You're here to promote Three Christs, which is open now, right?
Three Christ just opened. It's
tells the story of the real life story of a psychologist who studied three men who thought they were Christ.
Yeah, so
schizophrenics,
based on a true story.
A drama.
The late '50s, a drama. I play the guy who runs this asylum of sorts. Not a crazy asylum, more of a. Anyways, it's an institution.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way to deal with schizophrenia in 1958-59 was electroshock therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this doctor who came in, and there's a book written about the guy. He's really brilliant, that the movie's based on, that Richard Gere plays, who comes to this place, institution, and says, let's treat these patients. Let's talk to them. And he found that there were three patients in particular who thought they were Jesus Christ. He gathered them together, and this is where everyone laughs, myself included, and says, look, let's go with the premise that one of you is Christ, but it can only be one of you.
Right.
So let's figure this out.
Okay.
Which one of you is Jesus?
Right.
And I wish the movie were a comedy based on that setup, but it is based on that. And playing the character who runs the institution, I am not pleased with this upstart.
Yeah.
Who's trying something different? I have 2,100 patients. I can't take. There's no time for this.
And there are no drugs that treat schizophrenia in any way at that point,
no.
Right? There's nothing.
There's no take your meds and shut up.
So did this work? Did it help them?
You'll have to see the movie to find out. Of course it did. Otherwise, people would say, why am I making this movie?
I mean, because you got three Jesuses.
It helps to a certain degree. You know, schizophrenia
right, right.
is not something that just goes away.
No, I know.
Unless you have meds and you can mm-hmm. treat it, but... But again, so anyways, there's that little very scary movie, Apparition, opened the end of December. That's scaring people that I'm in. I play a sadistic guy in that. Terrific fun. And then the end of January, I don't know if you're a hockey guy, but there's a movie called Goalie, which is a story of Terry Sawchuk, a great record-breaking goalie from the 50s who was one of the last goalies to not wear a mask. You know, originally
right.
they didn't wear masks.
Yeah, I know.
And took a lot of pucks to the
yeah.
face.
Uh-huh.
That's why I play Jack Adams, this famous, almost infamous. There's a Jack Adams trophy. There's a Jack Adams league. I mean, the guy went on to be legendary himself. So Mark O'Brien plays Terry Sawchuk, and it's an extraordinary
So wait, you're
story.
On the ice.
So
you're on the
when
ice.
Talking to the director, I said, so at no point, my character is a former player,
right.
manager, and now a GM in the front office.
Got
I'm
going
to stay in the front office, right? There's not a point where I'm on the ice? And she said, no, he's not on the ice. I said, okay, then we can talk.
Yeah. You also have this covernowfund.org.
And bless you for asking.
National Emergency Fund for men and women of law enforcement. This isn't like... You know, these phone calls I get about the National Policeman's Fund, right, where you're...
So there's never been a Wounded Warrior type program on a national level for men and women in law enforcement.
Right.
It's all regional, and there's a lot mm-hmm. of cities and states that just don't have money. So the two issues we're attacking for covernowfund.org
mm-hmm.
is suicide is now three times the number of officers killed in the line of duty. Let that sink in for a
Just
moment.
Like soldiers coming back from...
Yeah, these
My
don't
service.
Come back. And their families are left usually with the last paycheck.
Right, right.
The officers aren't old enough to have a pension, which is the mm-hmm. majority of the cases.
Mm-hmm.
The family gets the last paycheck. So we're trying to help them through as many months as we can. The other one is catastrophic injury to officers in the line of duty.
Mm-hmm.
Catastrophic meaning they'll never work again. And so there's insurance companies that kick in. But like any big insurance company, they can't wait to stop paying. And no, you don't need that wheelchair. You
right,
need this
right.
one. And,
yep.
and so Wounded Warriors and programs like that have done extraordinary things for military in the same situation. There's never been a national relief fund for the men and women in law enforcement, and covernowfund.org is it.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what inspired you to do that?
I was just asked by the founder and CEO, this guy named Jeff Stein, who is an officer, medically retired, and found that this was a gigantic problem.
A big hole, right?
And came to me just for some support on a celebrity level. And, you know, we get asked to be in part of charity things. I write checks. I go to places. Bob Saget's got scleroderma. There's the great thing in Kansas City for Children's Mercy Hospital I go to every year. But I'd never been on the board of directors and focused my attention on one thing. So when Jeff came to me and talked to me about this, I realized I'd spent my whole life saying to any police officer I came across, thank you for your service.
Mm-hmm.
They seem like actual superheroes who dress up in their in their armor,
yep,
and do battle every day. And their life,
yeah,
and their life is being threatened on a minute-by-minute basis.
Yes.
That every time they punch in for the day's,
yep,
work, they're under siege basically at any moment. So for some reason as a kid when I was reading comic books, cops were that.
Mm-hmm.
Military were out of town. Police officers were in my face and I would see them. And so anyways, I've always had that admiration and appreciation. And here was an opportunity to actually do something for them.
Right.
Instead of answering the call from the policeman's fund.
Yeah.
It was a national emergency relief fund. We'll be doing some fundraisers. I'll be contacting you soon.
A bunch of my friends from my hometown became cops in my hometown. Butchie.
Hometown of?
West Bridgewater, Massachusetts.
That's correct.
My little buddies, Butchie and Richie in the backyard that we used to play basketball and wiffle ball with. Butchie and Richie are both cops now in my hometown.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have nothing but respect for those guys, too. I don't understand how someone can get up and then maybe a few hours later be tackling somebody and rolling around.
Yeah.
And
no, that's
not knowing what's going to happen when that person rolls their window down when you pulled them over.
Yep.
You know, that
every
one
time.
Out of 1,000 times they, yep, put a gun in your face. It's scary stuff.
And I think you've tapped into another reason for my appreciation is any occupation that I look at and say, well, I'm not doing that.
Right.
Because I'm a coward. Right. Gets my attention.
I kind of want it. I still want to be a cop. I still like the idea of it.
Yeah, and by the way,
I don't like the paperwork. That's
sure.
What would stop me.
Well,
the same thing with car dealing, too. I don't want to do the paperwork. I like the selling of the car, and then I want to be done with
it. You got that from a TV show from the 60s.
What
I don't
do
like
mean?
The paperwork.
No, and I there's a
hey,
lot of
Pittsburgh,
paperwork.
Don't give me any more paperwork.
There is.
Yeah.
Exactly. But my co-host, Zuckerman, who's usually here, he and I think, would make a good couple of cops. We'd like to I wouldn't mind doing it for a day.
You should.
And I would probably arrest mostly moms in my neighborhood racing between schools trying to get their kids to school late because they're the violators.
Can I suggest that we write this script, by the way?
What do you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah?
I suggest we write this script because—
Part-time cops?
No. Possibly. If there's a, if that's a thing. But the personality that you and Zuckerman have—
Yes.
—as beat partner cops.
Yeah.
We've not seen that in a while. You know what I mean?
I don't. I might be too close to it.
Yeah.
But maybe.
We've not seen that in a while.
I would have to constantly keep him from shooting people.
Well, this is the place. Stop telling the audience.
Strangling
about
people.
The pilot episode.
Yes, that would be it. Well, this has been great. I've loved having you on here and meeting you, and I can't believe we've done an hour already.
My pleasure.
You've got so much to promote. Maisel, if you guys haven't seen it, you go. That's your co-viewing. That's the one. You got to watch that. He's also got Three Christs that's out right now. You got to check it out. And Apparition, available on video on demand, right?
Yep. And Goalie comes the end of the month.
Goalie at the end of the month. And the charity we were talking about is covernowfund.org. It's an emergency fund for the men and women of law enforcement and helps them. Wounded warrior type support. For police officers. How about that? Kevin Pollak. What a
My
guy.
Pleasure.
What a story.
I'm embarrassed I brought up the Tesla.
You're embarrassed you brought it up? Why?
Yeah, I could see it in your eyes. They kind of went dead.
Well, no.
It's not really a car to you.
No, they are. I like them. I do like them a lot. I have a great deal of respect for them. I was thinking of it.
You just said some of my best friends are black.
You said something that I picked up on right away, which is I've had three of these cars. I'm curious about your take on it. That isn't – you already love it. And I think back from my car matchmaker days when people need help with cars, when I hear that, I know I can help them. That person already knows what they like, and as long as they're happy, I'm happy,
Oh, yeah,
happy,
I wasn't
right?
looking for you to talk me out of it. And I think I also knew the answer, and I'm now not sure why I asked, because having listened to the show, I know that I think Porsche owns the majority of your heart.
Yes.
And there's a reason. In fact, there are several reasons.
Yeah.
And I've heard you talk about them.
Yes.
So if you're that, why would this electric sedan interest you?
Because they are. I was looking at them yesterday. Yeah. I built one yesterday. I have this love-hate relationship with the brand.
Yeah.
Where one minute I can't believe how this guy is running his company and what he's putting on Twitter, and the next minute I'm like, we should get two.
Did you see the assault vehicle of a truck?
What's that? Oh, I did. The Cybertruck.
It looks like an assault vehicle to me.
It's insane.
Yeah.
And I hated it. And then I came home and my kids had it on their little Roblox game and they love it. And now I like it. I'm in this weird relationship with him. And that's maybe what you saw in my eyes. It's like I still don't know what to think.
Yeah.
But obviously, people love these things.
Yeah. And I'm a fan of yours, and this was a great thrill
thank
for
you,
me.
Man. That's very, very nice.
I mean, very nice of you to say.
Well,
so I'll have to come back, and I'll
please come back and do your impression.
I'm
going
to bug you
couch.
About the cops. I think this is a show.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
All right. That was Kevin Pollak, everybody. We'll see you next week on Spike's Car Radio.
Thanks for listening to Spike's Car Radio. Download new episodes every Wednesday on the Podcast One app, or subscribe now at Apple Podcasts or PodcastOne.com.